evening. Thank you for coming. I'm Alan Pally, and I'm producer of public programs for the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts at Lincoln Center. Tonight's program is part of our series, Mystic Chords of Memory, Abraham Lincoln and the Performing Arts, which we present in celebration of the Abraham Lincoln Bicentennial. I want to welcome and thank the actors, Philip Bosco, Kathleen Chalfant, and Richard Easton. These are the artists whose generosity makes these programs possible. The critic Sheridan Morley once told me that, to the Redgraves, the theater is a temple. I saw what Sheridan meant 2 years ago on Shakespeare's birthday, when the lovely Natasha Richardson appeared on this stage. To Lincoln, too, the theater was a temple. Tonight, I would like to introduce Harold Holzer by reading excerpts from an insert that Natasha's husband, Liam Neeson, soon to play Lincoln in a film, wrote for Harold's new book, In Lincoln's Hand, His Original Manuscripts with Commentary by Distinguished Americans. Mr. Neeson's comments refer to Lincoln's 1863 letters to actor James Hackett. Many thoughts struck me, not least that Lincoln was feeling relaxed enough to answer non-urgent mail. The decisive Gettysburg victory must have finally warmed his heart and made him feel that victory was perhaps within sight, that this great trouble might soon be over. But Shakespeare's insight into the human condition also gave solace to Lincoln's deepening sense of tragedy as the Civil War progressed. Why Lincoln's insistence that nothing equals Macbeth, here is a play about power, politics, jealousy, treason, and planning war campaigns, all of which he is dealing with as president, while, like Macbeth, married to a woman who is as ambitious as he is and growing more paranoid. Perhaps Lincoln felt he too had blood on his hands from the continuing carnage. And regarding the Claudius soliloquy, one can only imagine the long, lonely nights and days where Lincoln must have confronted his id, analyzed the nature of the war and its consequences, and indeed, try to offer up prayers of forgiveness and blessed release. I do agree with Walt Whitman, Neeson's commentary ends, who said, what Shakespeare did in poetic expression, Abraham Lincoln essentially did in his personal and official life. The 16th President of the United States was a pretty good poet as well, and boy, could he write a letter. No wonder Hackett had it printed and distributed to all his friends. And that is all by Liam Neeson, excerpted from In Lincoln's Hands, the new book by the man whose presence here tonight gives our program the imprimatur. Please welcome Harold Holzer.
He nearly knew Shakespeare by heart. That was what a one-time clerk in an unsuccessful New Salem, Illinois log cabin grocery store remembered of his boss, a young future politician named Abraham Lincoln. His mind was skeptical, the clerk explained, and it was his deep humanity and that skeptical tinge of mind that made him love Shakespeare. Other early acquaintances may have differed about the source of his inspiration, but whenever his oldest friends remembered the voracious reader they knew in his salad days, they testified as one to his love of Shakespeare's works. He was a reader, a theater goer, an analyst, a devotee, sometimes even a critic. So much so that the bard's phrases crept into his day-to-day conversation, even on the prairie. Often in conversation, said a neighbor who watched the tall newcomer build a flatboat once, he would refer to that great man Shakespeare, sometimes to move others to his point of view. One day in 1847, lawyer Lincoln was defending an old farmer who had sold two young men a yoke of oxen and a plow. Then the youngsters refused to pay, insisting they were minors, and the old farmer knew it, and thus were not legally responsible for the debt. "Yes, gentlemen, I reckon that's so," Lincoln finally drawled to the jury. Then an eyewitness recalled, he slowly got up, and in his strange, half-erect attitude and clear, quiet accent began, "Gentlemen of the jury, are you willing to allow these boys to begin life with this shame and disgrace attached to their character? If you are, I am not. The best judge of human character that ever wrote has left these immortal words for all of us to ponder." And then he read these lines of Iago from Othello.
"Good name in man and woman, dear my lord, is the immediate jewel of their souls. Who steals my purse, steals trash. 'Tis something nothing. 'Twas mine, 'tis his, and has been slave to thousands. But he that filches from me my good name robs me of that which not enriches him and makes me poor indeed."
When he concluded with this recitation, Lincoln solemnly declared to the enraptured jury, "And now, gentlemen, you have it in your power to set these boys right before the world." Without leaving their seats, the jurors unanimously voted that the miners had to pay the debt after all. And as an eyewitness recalled after hearing Lincoln, if necessary, the jurors were willing to pay for it themselves. Many years later, when President Lincoln journeyed with the Union Army to Fortress Monroe, Virginia in May 1862, a military aide found him a very sad man, sad even beyond the terrible nature of his burden. "I suppose you have neither a Bible nor a copy of Shakespeare," Lincoln said despondently one day. "I replied that I had the General Shakespeare," the officer replied. The president asked, "Won't I lend it to him?" which of course I obtained. After that, he never missed a night without reading it. According to the officer, Colonel LeGrand Cannon, it's quite a name for a soldier, Lincoln also read aloud to him from Macbeth and Lear, and then turned to King John. His voice trembling, Lincoln recited the passages in which Constance bewails the loss of her child to the king, who believes she holds too heinous a respect of grief, that she is going mad, that she is perhaps as fond of grief as of your child.
"I am not mad. This hair I tear is mine. My name is Constance. I was Geoffrey's wife. Young Arthur is my son, and he is lost. I am not mad. I would to God I were, for then 'tis like I should forget myself. Oh, if I could, what grief should I forget? Preach some philosophy to make me mad, and thou shalt be canonized, Cardinal. For being not mad, but sensible of grief, my reasonable part produces reason, how I may be delivered of these woes, and teaches me to kill or hang myself. If I were mad, I should forget my son, or madly think a babe of clouts were he. I am not mad. Too well I feel the different plague of each calamity. And Father Cardinal, I have heard you say that we shall see and know our friends in heaven. If that be true, I shall see my boy again. For since the birth of Cain, the first male child to whom that did but yesterday suspire, there was not such a gracious creature born. But now will canker sorrow eat my bud and chase the native beauty from my cheek, and he will look as hollow as a ghost, as dim and meager as an ague's fit, and so he'll die, and rising so again, when I shall meet him in the court of heaven, I shall not know him. Therefore never, never must I behold my pretty Arthur more. Grief fills the room up of my absent child, lies in his bed, walks up and down with me, puts on his pretty looks, repeats his words, remembers me of all his gracious parts, stuffs out his vacant garments with his form. Then have I reason to be fond of grief? Fare you well. Had you such a loss as I could give better comfort than you do. Oh, Lord, my boy, my Arthur, my fair son, my life, my joy, my food, my all the world, my widow comfort, and my sorrow's cure.
I noticed he was deeply moved, the colonel recalled. Laying the book on the table, he said, "Did you ever dream of a lost friend and feel that you were having a direct communication with that friend, and yet a consciousness that it was not a reality? I do. I dream of my boy Willie, who had just died 3 months earlier." And then Lincoln was utterly overcome. His great frame shook, and bowing down on the table, he wept as only such a man in the breaking down of a great sorrow can weep. It was, the officer recalled, like a sacred confidence. He quietly left the cabin that he might recover without restraint. But Lincoln's taste for Shakespeare's comedy, too, particularly the character of Falstaff, was strong. He saw Henry IV in March 1863 at the Washington Theater, and 9 months later, an encore performance at Ford's Theater. As his secretary remembered, the president showed a very intimate knowledge of those plays of Shakespeare where Falstaff figures. Then, as we heard, he befriended the most famous Falstaff of his time, James Hackett, and invited him to the White House to recite for him and to express his own strong viewpoint on how the lines should be read. These from Falstaff's boastful report to his prince were among Lincoln's favorites, even though he complained that they were often misrecited.
"There is nothing but roguery to be found in villainous man. Yet a coward is worse than a cup of sack with lime in it. A villainous coward! Go thy ways, old Jack. Die when thou wilt. If manhood, good manhood, be not forgot upon the face of the earth, then am I a shotten herring. There lives not three good men unhanged in England, and one of them is fat, and grows old. God help the world. A bad world, I say. I would I were a weaver. I could sing psalms or anything. A plague of all cowards, I say. I have escaped by a miracle. I'm 8 times thrust through the doublet, 4 through the hose, my buckler cut through and through, my sword hacked like a handsaw, ecce signum. I never dealt better since I was a man. All would not do. Plague of all cowards. Let them speak. If they speak more or less than truth, they are villains and sons of darkness. 4 rogues in buckram let drive at me. These 4 came all affront and mainly thrust at me. These 4 I made me no more ado but took all their 7 points on my target thus."
Lincoln was such a close reader of Shakespeare that he objected to the way Hackett recited those lines. "It should not be thrust at me," he insisted. "It could only be read thrust at me." He asked Hackett to recite it for him again, his way.
"These 4 came all affront and mainly thrust at me. I made no more ado but took all their 7 points on my target.
Not everyone shared Lincoln's inexhaustible enthusiasm. He liked to corner his staff and recite to them when they were trying to catch precious sleep. Late one night at the president's summer residence, the soldier's home outside Washington, his private secretary, John Hay, became his captive audience as Lincoln read from the end of one of the plays of Henry VI. Hay left no record of which part or which soliloquy, but given Lincoln's ironic interest in ruminations on war, disorder, and sacrifice, perhaps it was this speech by young Clifford at the end of Henry VI, Part II.
Shame and confusion, all is on the rout. Fear frames disorder, and disorder wounds where it should guard. O war, thou son of hell, whom angry heavens do make their minister, throw in the frozen bosoms of our part hot coals of vengeance. Let no soldier fly. He that is truly dedicate to war hath no self-love, nor he that loves himself hath not essentially, but by circumstance, the name of valor.
How did Hay react to a message so laden with meaning for their own time? He nodded off. He admitted, and when, as he put it, my heavy eyelids caught his considerable notice, he sent me to bed. But that never stopped Lincoln from taking Shakespeare to bed himself. One day, after returning to the White House in February 1864, after seeing Edwin Booth, no less, in The Merchant of Venice, Lincoln turned to a newspaper correspondent and said, "It was a good performance, but I had 1,000 times rather read it at home, if it were not for Booth's playing. A farce or a comedy is best played. A tragedy is best read at home." Here are some of the words Lincoln heard that night from the brother of the man who, remember, just a few years later, would murder him.
"To baked fish withal. If it will feed nothing else, it will feed my revenge. He hath disgraced me and hindered me 500,000. Laughed at my losses, mocked at my gains, scorned my nation, thwarted my bargains, cooled my friends, heated mine enemies. And what's his reason? I am a Jew. Hath not a Jew eyes? Hath not a Jew hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions, fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer as a Christian is? If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge? If we are like you in the rest, we will resemble you in that. If a Jew wrong a Christian, what is his humility? Revenge. If a Christian wrong a Jew, what should his sufferings be by Christian example? Why, revenge. The villainy you teach me, I will execute, and it shall go hard, but I will better the instruction."
It occurs to me in hearing that reading that shortly after seeing the play, Abraham Lincoln overturned the longtime chaplaincy restrictions in the United States Army that forbade Jews from serving as military chaplains, and also overturned General Grant's order barring Jews entirely from the Western military department. Interesting. Particularly fascinated by plays about politics, especially if they featured heroic death, assassination, and eulogy, Lincoln must have felt a particularly deep attraction to Julius Caesar, which he saw near his 55th birthday in 1864. He no doubt gave much thought to how first Antony, then Brutus, as played that night by Edwin Booth, contemplated the murder of the nation's leader.
"Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is oft interred with their bones. So let it be with Caesar. The noble Brutus has told you Caesar was ambitious. If it were so, it was a grievous fault, and grievously hath Caesar answered it. Here, under leave of Brutus and the rest, for Brutus is an honorable man. So are they all honorable men. Come I to speak in Caesar's funeral. He was my friend, faithful and just to me. But Brutus says he was ambitious. And Brutus is an honorable man. He hath brought many captives home to Rome, whose ransoms did the general coffers fill. Did this in Caesar seem ambitious? When that the poor have cried, Caesar hath wept. Ambition should be made of sterner stuff. Yet Brutus says he was ambitious, and Brutus is an honorable man. You all did see that on the Lupercal I thrice presented him a kingly crown, which he did thrice refuse. Was this ambition? Yet Brutus says he was ambitious, and sure he is an honorable man. I speak not to disprove what Brutus spoke, but here I am to speak what I do know. You all did love him once, not without cause. What cause withholds you then to mourn for him? O judgment, thou art fled to brutish beasts, and men have lost their reason. Bear with me. My heart is in the coffin there with Caesar, and I must pause till it come back to me.
No, Cassius, no. Think not, thou noble Roman, that ever Brutus will go bound to Rome. He bears too great a mind. But this same day must end the work the Ides of March begun. And whether we shall meet again, I know not. Therefore, our everlasting farewell take. Forever and forever, farewell, Cassius. If we do meet again, why, we shall smile. If not, why then, this parting was well made.
One day in January 1865, President Lincoln took Senator Charles Sumner to Ford's Theater to see Edwin Forrest in King Lear. His little boy, Tad, accompanied the party, and the play about a father and his children confused the 12-year-old. But whenever Tad asked for an explanation, the president would reply only, "My child, it is all in the play." For Lincoln, it was all in the play. But when Edmund was stabbed to death and offered a few final lines, Lincoln turned to his guests in the theater box and said, "I have only one reproach to make of Shakespeare's heroes, that they make long speeches when they're killed." Here is one of Lincoln's favorite soliloquies from Lear, also from Edmund, from Act One, Scene Two.
"Thou, nature, art my goddess. To thy law my services are bound. Wherefore should I stand in the plague of custom and permit the curiosity of nations to deprive me, for that I am some 12 or 14 moonshines lag of a brother? Why, bastard, wherefore base, when my dimensions are as well compact, my mind as generous, and my shape as true as honest madam's issue? Why brand they us with base? With baseness, bastardy, base. Who in the lusty stealth of nature take more composition and fierce quality than doth within a dull, stale, tired bed go to the creating a whole tribe of fops got tween asleep and wake? Well then, legitimate Edgar, I must have your land. Our father's love is to the bastard Edmund as to the legitimate. fine word, legitimate. Well, my legitimate, if this letter speed and my invention thrive, Edmund the base shall top the legitimate. I grow, I prosper. Now, gods, stand up for bastards.
Lincoln's range of analytical thought about Shakespeare can only be described as breathtaking. The opening of the play of King Richard III, Lincoln once confided to an artist painting his portrait, seems to me often entirely misapprehended. It is quite common for an actor to come upon the stage and in a sophomoric style to begin with a flourish, "Now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by this son of York." After reciting a few more lines in this grandiloquent style, Lincoln added, "Now this is all wrong. Richard, you remember, had been and was then plotting the destruction of his brothers to make room for himself. Outwardly the most loyal to the newly crowned king, secretly, he could scarcely contain his impatience at the obstacles still in the way of his own elevation." This is still Lincoln. He appears upon the stage just after the crowning of Edward, burning with repressed hatred and jealousy. The prologue, Lincoln insisted, is the utterance of the most intense bitterness and hate. Whereupon, the artist remembered, he repeated from memory the entire soliloquy, rendering it with a degree of force and power that made it seem like a new creation. And this is what he recited.
"Now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by this son of York. And all the clouds that lowered upon our house, in the deep bosom of the ocean buried. Now are our brows bound with victorious wreaths, our bruised arms hung up from monuments, our stern alarums changed to merry meetings, our dreadful marches to delightful measures. Grim-visaged war has smoothed his wrinkled front. And now, instead of mounting barbed steeds to fright the souls of fearful adversaries, he capers nimbly in a lady's chamber to the lascivious pleasings of a lute. But I, that am not shaped for sportive tricks, nor made to court an amorous looking glass, I, that am rudely stamped, and want love's majesty to strut before a wanton ambling nymph. I, that am curtailed of this fair proportion, cheated of feature by dissembling nature, deformed, unfinished, sent before my time into this breathing world scarce half made up, and that so lamely and unfashionable that dogs bark at me as I halt by them. Why, I, in this weak, piping time of peace, have no delight to pass away the time, unless to spy my shadow in the sun and descant on mine own deformity. And therefore, since I cannot prove a lover to entertain these fair, well-spoken days, I'm determined to prove a villain and hate the idle pleasures of these days. Plots have I laid, inductions dangerous, by drunken prophecies, libels, and dreams, to set my brother Clarence and the king in deadly hate the one against the other. And if King Edward be as true and just as I am subtle, false, and treacherous, this day should Clarence closely be mewed up about a prophecy which says that G of Edward's heirs, the murderer, shall be. I have thoughts down to myself. Here Clarence comes.
Some of Lincoln's plays I have never read, Lincoln confessed candidly, almost embarrassingly, to the Shakespearean actor James Hackett in 1863, while others I have gone over perhaps as frequently as any unprofessional reader. Among the latter, he revealed in his letter, are Lear, Richard III, Hamlet, and, surprisingly, at least to me, Henry VIII. Perhaps because this speech appeared in one of his childhood primers, Scott's Lessons in Elocution, or, because of its stern warning, the paths of glory lead but to the glory, or, merely because one of the characters in the play is named Lincoln, the Bishop of Lincoln. And here is Cardinal Wolsey's soliloquy from Act III.
So farewell to the little good you bear me. Farewell, a long farewell to all my greatness. This is the state of man. Today he puts forth the tender leaves of hopes. Tomorrow blossoms and bears his blushing honors thick upon him. The third day comes a frost, a killing frost. And when he thinks good easy man full surely, his greatness is a ripening, nips his root, and then he falls. As I do. I have ventured like little wanton boys that swim on bladders this many summers in a sea of glory. But far beyond my depth, my high-blown pride at length broke under me and now has left me weary and old with service to the mercy of a rude stream that must forever hide me. Vain pomp and glory of this world, I hate ye. I feel my heart new opened. Oh, how wretched is that poor man that hangs on prince's favors. There is betwixt that smile we would aspire to the sweet aspect of princes and their ruin. More pangs and fears than wars or women have. And when he falls like Lucifer, never to hope again.
Lincoln had read Richard and Hamlet frequently, he said, but especially, he confessed, Macbeth. As Lincoln put it in his letter to Hackett, I think nothing equals Macbeth. It is wonderful. Particularly, he thought, this from Act One, Macbeth's speech.
If it were done when 'tis done, then farewell. It were done quickly if the assassination could trammel up the consequence and catch with his surcease success, that but this blow might be the be-all and the end-all here, but here, upon this bank and shoal of time, we jump the life to come. But in these cases, we still have judgment here, that we but teach bloody instruction, which being taught returns to plague the inventor. This even-handed justice commends the ingredients of our poison chalice to our own lips. He's here in double trust. First, as I'm his kinsman and his subject, strong both against the deed. Then, as his host, who should against his murderer shut the door, not bear the knife myself. Besides, this Duncan hath borne himself so meek, hath been so clear in his great office that his virtues will plead like angels trumpet-tongued against the deep damnation of his taking off, and pity, like a naked newborn babe striding the blast, or heaven's cherubim horsed upon the sightless couriers of the air. So blow the horrid deed in every eye. The tears shall drown the wind. I have no spur to prick the sides of mine tent, but only vaulting ambition, which o'erleaps itself and falls on the other.
It was a play about vaulting ambition, yes, and conspiracy and assassination and revenge. And yet he loved it above all other plays of Shakespeare, because perhaps in its disorder, it advocated the reverse, just as Hamlet's indecisiveness called for firmness. Here is Macbeth again, speaking from Act Two.
Is this a dagger that I see before me? The handle toward my hand. Come, let me clutch thee. I have thee not, yet I see thee still. Art thou not fatal vision, sensible to feeling as to sight? Or art thou but a dagger of the mind, a false creation, proceeding from the heat-oppressed brain? I see thee yet, in form as palpable as this, which now I draw. Thou marshalest me the way that I was going, and such an instrument I was to use. Mine eyes have made the fools of the other senses. Or else worth all the rest, I see thee still. And on my blade and dudgeon, gouts of blood, which was not so before. There's no such thing. It is this bloody business which informs thus to mine eye. Now, for the one half world, nature seems dead, and wicked dreams abuse the curtained sleep. Witchcraft celebrates pale Hecate's offerings, and withered murder, alarumed by his sentinel, the wolf, whose howls his watch, thus with his stealthy pace, with Tarquin's ravishing strides, towards his design, moves like a ghost. Thou sure and firm set earth, hear not my steps, which way they walk, for fear thy very stones prate of my whereabout, and take the present horror from the time which now suits with it. While I threat, he lives. Words to the heat of deeds, to cold breath gives. I go, and it is done. The bell invites me. Hear it not, Duncan, for it is a knell that summons thee to heaven, or to hell.
Unlike you gentlemen of the profession, Lincoln once told actor Hackett, I think the soliloquy in Hamlet commencing, oh, my offense is rank, surpasses that commencing to be or not to be. And then he quickly added, but pardon that small attempt at criticism. Here is the more celebrated of the two speeches, which Lincoln first read as a boy and saw performed in 1863 and then twice more in 1864.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them, to die, to sleep, no more, and by a sleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to, 'tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. To die, to sleep perchance, to dream, aye, there's the rub. For in that sleep of death, what dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil must give us pause. There's the respect that makes calamity of so long life. For who would bear the whips and scorns of time, the oppressor's wrong, the proud man's contumely, the pangs of despised love, the law's delay, the insolence of office and the spurns that patient merit of the unworthy takes when he himself might his quietus make with a bare bodkin? Who would fardels bear to grunt and sweat under a weary life, but that the dread of something after death, the undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveler returns, puzzles the will and makes us rather bear those ills we have than fly to others that we know not of. Thus, conscience does make cowards of us all, and thus the native hue of resolution is sicklied o'er with the pale cast of thought, and enterprises of great pith and moment with this regard their currents turn awry and lose the name of action. Soft you now, the fair Ophelia, nymph in thy orisons, be all my sins remembered.
There is one passage of the play of Hamlet Lincoln insisted in 1864, which is very apt to be slurred over by the actor or omitted altogether, which seems to me the choicest part of the play. It is the soliloquy of the king after the murder. It always struck me as one of the finest touches of nature in the world. Was this the view of a lover of literature or of a ruler filled with guilt over the oceans of blood spilled in his own cause, perhaps who preferred the king's anguish to Hamlet's indecisiveness, or perhaps simply because it had been printed in one of the very first books he ever read as a boy? Here is the soliloquy of King Claudius from Act 3, Scene 3 of Hamlet.
Oh, my offense is rank. It smells to him. It hath the primal elder's curse upon it. A brother's murder. Pray, can I not, though inclination be as sharp as a will? My stronger guilt defeats my strong intent. And like a man to double business bound, I stand in pause where I shall first begin. And both neglect. What if this cursed hand were thicker than itself with brother's blood? Is there not rain enough in the sweet heavens to wash it white as snow? Whereto serves mercy but to confront the visage of offense? And what's in prayer but this twofold force, to be forestalled ere we come to fall, or pardoned, being down? Then I look up, my fault is past, but oh, what form of prayer can serve my turn? Forgive me my foul murder, it cannot be, since I am still possessed of those effects for which I did the murder, my crown, mine own ambition, and my queen. May one be pardoned and retain the offense? In the corrupted currents of this world, offense's gilded hand may shove by justice, and oft 'tis seen the wicked prize itself buys out the law. But 'tis not so above. There is no shuffling, there the action lies in his true nature. And we ourselves, compelled even to the teeth and forehead of our faults, to give in evidence. What then? What rests? Try what repentance can. What can it not? Yet what can it when one cannot repent? Oh, wretched state! Oh, bosom black as death! Oh, limed soul that's struggling to be free, but not engaged! Help, angels! Make essay! Bow, stubborn knees, and heart with strings of steel, be soft as sinews of the newborn babe. All may be well.
Lincoln had freely and somewhat naively shared all these views about Shakespeare with Hackett in gratitude for the actor's gift, a copy of his book, Notes and Comments Upon Certain Plays and Actors of Shakespeare. But then Hackett published their private correspondence in a pamphlet, and Lincoln was soon under attack by newspapers in England and America for daring to express his literary views. Hackett wrote to offer his apologies for the satirical abuse, and Lincoln wrote once again to tell the actor not to worry. Those comments, Lincoln sighed, constitute a fair specimen of what has occurred to me through life. I have endured a great deal of ridicule without much malice, and have received a great deal of kindness, not entirely free of ridicule. I am used to it. This time, Lincoln marked his letter private. In the end, as Lincoln told a contemporary, it matters not to me whether Shakespeare be well or ill acted. With me, the thought suffices. Those thoughts might be uplifting or rollicking, but most often they were forbidding and portentous, expressing the dread Lincoln seemed to feel about his own judgment day, though surely he could not realize, or could he, that that day of his own almost Shakespearean reckoning was approaching so quickly. One senses his particular fascination with one story he knew well, Henry V. Here is William's rumination on war, sacrifice, leadership, and honor.
But if the cause be not good, the king himself had a heavy reckoning to make. When all those legs and arms and heads chopped off in a battle shall join together at the latter day and cry, oh, we died at such a place. Some swearing, some crying for a surgeon, some upon their wives left poor behind them, some upon the debts they owe, some upon their children rawly left. I'm afeard there few die well that die in a battle. For how can they charitably dispose of anything when blood is their argument? Now, if these men do not die well, it'll be a black matter for the king that led them to it, whom to disobey were against all proportion of subjection.
Americans had come to know well how very much their beleaguered president loved Shakespeare. Hostile cartoonists had even depicted him as the skull exhumed by Hamlet in the gravedigger scene, a fellow of infinite jest, or as Othello in blackface, using Shakespeare's words to imply the supposed horrors of his emancipation policy. Oh, that the slave had 40,000 lives. I am not valiant neither, but why should honor outlive honesty? Let it go all. And then came his own murder and martyrdom, accompanied, perhaps, he would have been relieved to know, by no prolonged soliloquies in the throes of death, just awful silence. But when one very savvy artist issued a depiction of Lincoln being shot to death in a theater, no less, and worse, at the hand of an actor, he could not resist a caption for this picture that highlighted the lines from Lincoln's very favorite play, those Macbeth uttered about Duncan, words Lincoln had read and heard so many times, and which, in paraphrase, now seemed to summarize a nation's loss and history's gain.
This Lincoln hath borne his faculties so meek, has been so clear in his great office, that his virtues shall plead trumpet-tongued against the deep damnation of his taking off.
Lincoln's White House Secretary, John Hay, remember that one of the president's favorite of all Shakespeare's speeches was Richard II's lament. It is an ending altogether fitting and proper, to paraphrase Lincoln, to an exploration of a president's love for a playwright.
For heaven's sake, let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the death of kings, how some have been deposed, some slain in war, some haunted by the ghosts they have deposed, some poisoned by their wives, some sleeping killed, all murdered. For within the hollow crown that rounds the mortal temples of a king keeps death his court, and there the antic sits, scoffing his state and grinning at his pomp, allowing him a breath, a little scene to monarchize, be feared, and kill with looks, infusing him with self and vain conceit, as if this flesh which walls about our life were brass impregnable, and humored thus comes at the last, and with a little pin bores through his castle walls, and farewell, king.
In one of Lincoln's own rare laments about the high cost of war, he told a crowd in the nation's birthplace, Philadelphia, that this war, in its magnitude and duration, is one of the most terrible. It has destroyed property and ruined homes and produced a national debt and taxation unprecedented. And then, looking beyond the practical, on the only occasion I know of that he ever tried to use rather than sort of infuse Lincoln's words in his own rhetoric, he added a phrase from Henry VI, which then and now described war's terrible impact on human life. It has carried mourning to almost every home until it can almost be said that the heavens are hung in black. In less than a year, they would be hung in black for the war's most enduring hero and its most preeminent admirer of William Shakespeare. Those who were aboard for Lincoln's final boat ride home to Washington from the conquered Confederate capital of Richmond, a trip that should have made him joyful, would never forget the lines from Macbeth that he recited with such portent and such melancholy.
After life's fitful fever, he sleeps well. Treason has done his worst. Nor steel, nor poison, malice domestic, foreign levy, nothing can touch him further.